So I think we'll get started again with our final speaker. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Rita Nanda to come to speak to us. She is presides in the city that's I feel is my second favorite city besides Omaha. So it's great to have somebody from Chicago. She has really spent her whole career there at the University of Chicago Medical School Residency Fellowship. And now she is the director of the breast program, clinical breast program at the University of Chicago. And we're very excited for her to be here to speak on breast cancer.
Stage is a little wobbly, but well, thank you so much, and it was such an honor for me to be invited to speak today, and thank you for taking time out of your Saturday to be here. I was asked to speak a little bit on the emerging role of immunotherapy for specifically for triple-negative breast cancer, although immunotherapy is being investigated in other tumor types as well, but I think where we've got an approval now and the most active investigation, so I really just focused to this on triple-negative breast cancer. So here are my disclosures. You know, I do a lot of advising and consulting in the context of clinical trials, but just specifically for this program here, no conflicts of interest. So breast cancer is a little bit behind other tumor types in terms of immunotherapy approvals, and a lot of that has been because breast cancer was not believed to be immunogenically active initially. But there are a number of observations that have been made over the last decade that have suggested there may be a role for immunotherapy in a subset of breast cancers, and the rationale has been the strongest for triple-negative disease. So we know that of all of the different breast cancer subtypes, triple-negative breast cancer is characterized by the most robust immune infiltrate. So triple-negative breast cancer has the most number of immune cells in the tumor microenvironment as compared to other types of breast cancer. We also know that triple-negative breast cancer is associated with a higher level of PD-L1 expression, so it may make sense that PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 therapies may be more effective for triple-negative breast cancer. And we also know that triple-negative breast cancer, of all the different subtypes, is the subtype that's most genomically unstable and can be characterized by a number of mutations, which may then elicit an immune response. So all of these observations, coupled with the great unmet need in triple-negative breast cancer, led to many of the initial trials being done in triple-negative breast cancer. Oh, wow. It's going a little crazy. I'm done. Everybody can go. Sorry, I don't know. Did I do something? Do you want to reload? Okay, sorry. Wow, that was a fast one. Sorry, I don't know what I did. I apologize. Just kind of went crazy. Well, while we're waiting for the slides to reload, I just really, this talk is structured as kind of an overview of what we know to date and some of the work that's been done over the last few years. And then I end by, you know, just updates from San Antonio and potentially maybe some additional indications for breast cancer coming down the line. So I'm pushing the button, but it's not advancing. It advances very slowly. Okay, sorry. I don't know if the battery's low or something. So there have been a number of studies that have looked at checkpoint inhibitors as monotherapy for triple-negative breast cancer. Okay, sorry. Okay, thank you. Sorry, no mouse, but I'll try to point things out. So a number of trials have looked at monotherapy. Pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, avelumab have all been studied for triple-negative breast cancer as monotherapy, and the response rates have been pretty modest. For triple-negative breast cancer patients who've received therapy for advanced stage disease, response rates are really under 10%. For those patients who are receiving immunotherapy, either pembrolizumab or atezolizumab as their first-line therapy, you can see response rates approach that mid-20% range. And that's pretty comparable to what we see with chemotherapy in that setting. We've looked at a variety of different biomarkers to see if we might be able to identify who are those patients who are most likely to benefit from checkpoint inhibition. And what we found that is that PD-L1 positivity can enrich for responders, but is not a great biomarker of response to therapy. Here you can see that for those patients with advanced triple negative breast cancer who received atezolizumab monotherapy for their advanced stage disease, there was a modest improvement, trend improvement in overall survival as compared to those patients who did not have PD-L1 staining in their tumor microenvironment. When we look at the presence of TILs, so these T lymphocytes in the presence of the tumor microenvironment, that actually does correspond a little bit better than PD-L1 status to who's most likely to benefit from these therapies. So it makes sense, right? What do these therapies do? They activate anergic or not non-functioning T cells in the tumor microenvironment. So if those immune cells are there to be activated, it kind of makes sense that that should correlate with a better response to these therapies. And you can see here that there is a trend in improvement in overall survival for those triple negative breast cancers that are characterized by a high level of immune infiltrate in their tumor microenvironment and a doubling in median overall survival. From the KEYNOTE-86 trial of pembrolizumab monotherapy for advanced breast cancer, what we did see is that those patients whose tumors are characterized by a dense immune infiltrate and who receive pembrolizumab as their first treatment for advanced stage disease, we can get those response rates up into that 40% ballpark area. So still quite modest, and there's still a lot of work that we need to do, but to date, PD-L1 positivity can enrich for who's going to respond to therapy, so can the presence of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes in the tumor microenvironment, and then the line of therapy. Those are the three things that we've observed to date that help us enrich for who's going to respond to these therapies alone. Now, you might say, look, the response rates are so modest. You know, if you take the all-comer frontline triple-negative patients, your response rates are just similar to what we get with chemotherapy in that mid-20% response rate. But this is where the similarities end. These agents, if patients do respond to them, can be associated with very durable responses. When you think about chemotherapy in that frontline setting, the median duration of response is about 5 months. But you can see here that a subset of these patients who respond to this therapy can respond for a very long time. I've personally seen patients have their disease under control for 2 years plus, and probably a very small subset of patients may actually even be cured of their advanced stage disease. So that's what gets us very excited about immunotherapy for triple negative breast cancer, not just the responses that we see, but the durability of these responses, and also the side effect profile can be quite favorable as compared to chemotherapy. Now, what we do know, and we're learning more and more about each day, is that one size isn't going to fit all. Not everyone's going to respond to immunotherapy, and we certainly need to think about different strategies for attacking different tumors. So the vast majority of breast cancers are believed to be immunogenically silent, so characterized by that immune desert slide there. There are no immune cells in the tumor microenvironment. There are no immune cells at the periphery of the tumor, like is the case for the immune excluded in the upper right-hand purple box there, where you do have immune cells, but there's some sort of barrier that's keeping them from infiltrating into the tumor. And these subtypes of breast cancer or other cancers really aren't very immunogenically active and aren't necessarily the types of tumors that are going to benefit from checkpoint inhibitors alone. The inflamed tumor, where you see these immune infiltrates inside the tumor bed, are the subtype where these checkpoint inhibitors can be effective as monotherapy potentially, because the immune cells are there, but they're just not killing the tumor. So there are a number of different combination strategies that have been investigated for breast cancer. So in thinking about how cancer cells interface with the immune system, and this is a nice cartoon that really simplifies it, but I think is a really good way to think about how cancer cells interface with the immune system. We know that cancer cells, as they die, can release antigens. And these antigens are taken up by dendritic cells, which are the antigen-presenting cells, and they present these antigens to T cells. These T cells then get activated, they travel to the site of the tumor, infiltrate into the tumor, and then identify the cancer cells as bad and kill them, and then in turn release more antigens. So it's a self-propagating cycle, and if we can understand how any given tumor evades the immune system and is able to grow and to metastasize, I think we're going to make great strides in capitalizing on the modest success we've seen from immunotherapy to date. So you can see here in red, I've typed in some of the different strategies that are being looked at. I left off radiation, which can potentially augment the release of antigens. So that may be one of the reasons where, you know, if you've got micrometastatic disease and radiation potentially kills these cells, that you can, you know, sort of enhance an immune response by activating the release of these antigens. So chemotherapy, PARP inhibitors, AKT, MEK inhibitors are all being investigated. And I'm going to present some of those data that were presented earlier this year at ASCO. So one of the natural inclinations was to combine chemotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors. There are a number of chemotherapy drugs that we use to treat breast cancer that can actually elicit an immune response. The taxanes, the alkylating agents like cyclophosphamide, the anthracyclines can all stimulate an anti-tumor immune response. So historically, many of the trials have looked at nab-paclitaxel, which is a taxane-based chemotherapy that doesn't require steroid premedication. But I think we're learning more and more that the modest amounts of steroid premeds we need to use for a variety of these different chemotherapies likely don't impact the activity of checkpoint inhibitors. So the IMPASSION 130 trial is a randomized phase 3 trial that has led to the first and only approval of checkpoint inhibitors for advanced, for breast cancer, period, but is indicated in the advanced triple-negative breast cancer setting. So the IMPASSION 130 trial enrolled patients with triple-negative breast cancer. PD-L1 positive or PD-L1 negative tumors were allowed to be entered into the study, and patients were enrolled in a one-to-one fashion to chemotherapy alone with nab-paclitaxel or nab-paclitaxel plus atezolizumab. And the co-primary endpoints for this trial were progression-free survival and overall survival for the overall population, as well as for the PD-L1 positive population. And in this study, about 40% of patients were found to have PD-L1 positive disease. It's important to note that the Ventana SP142 assay was the assay used for determining PD-L1 positivity in this study, and only looking at infiltrating immune cells. And I think for a lot of you who treat many different tumor types, you know there are many different antibodies out there and different methods of determining PD-L1 positivity, but that's what was used for this clinical trial. And you can see here the results. There was a significant improvement in progression-free survival of about 2.5 months for patients who received atezolizumab in combination with chemotherapy as compared to chemotherapy alone. But that really was driven by the PD-L1 positive population, where you can see a more significant improvement in progression-free survival. For those patients who had PD-L1 positive disease, those curves overlapped. I haven't included that here, but there was really no benefit to adding atezolizumab to chemotherapy. In looking at the overall survival in the left lower hand corner, you can see there was no significant improvement in overall survival. But when you look at the PD-L1 positive cohort, you can see a really nice separation of the curves. In blue, you can see the median progression-free survival for those patients who got atezolizumab, a 10-month improvement. Now, on the second update, it was down to 7 months, but still a really nice separation of these curves. And this study led to the FDA approval of the combination of nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab for patients with PD-L1 positive triple negative breast cancer, and that is our only indication for immunotherapy at this point. So obviously really exciting to get that approval, I think in May of last year, but certainly a lot more that we need to do. There have been a number of other studies looking at checkpoint inhibitors as well in different ways. The TONIC trial was a really interesting trial that looked at this concept of using chemotherapy or even radiation therapy as induction and then treating patients with nivolumab. A really small study, but they looked at a number of different, and these were triple negative patients, not necessarily in the frontline setting. And you can see in the blue graph here, doxorubicin, so just two doses of weekly doxorubicin given at 15 milligrams per IV 2 weeks in a row, followed by nivolumab, had a response rate of 35%. Again, these are really small numbers, but when you look at the platinums, the alkylating agents, and even radiation, you don't see as dramatic of an improvement in the response rates. So there's a much larger randomized phase 2 trial that is ongoing now. But really interesting, this concept of induction therapy. So maybe giving a little chemo up front, maybe eliciting an immune response, and then capitalizing on that with anti-PD-1 therapy is a really exciting strategy. And I think certainly something we'll be hearing more about in the future. We heard a little bit about induction chemotherapy followed by maintenance durvalumab at San Antonio this year. And this was a randomized phase 2 trial presented by the French group called the SAPPHIRE 2 trial. And so this trial, it was really just the bottom right-hand corner that was presented at San Antonio this year. But this trial enrolled patients with metastatic HER2-negative breast cancer. So hormone receptor-positive patients were eligible as well. They were treated with 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy, and provided they had a response or had stable disease, were then randomized. They had genomic testing done, next-gen sequencing. If they had a targetable molecular alteration, they were randomized to the top half of the study. But if they didn't, then they were randomized to either durvalumab monotherapy or continuing their chemotherapy that they were either stable or having a response to. And they were randomized to immunotherapy and versus maintenance chemotherapy in a 2-to-1 fashion. These were relatively young patients, a median age of 56. Again, about 40% of these patients had triple negative breast cancer, although there was a slight imbalance between the durvalumab and control arms, and the rest had hormone receptor positive disease. About a third had PD-L1 positive disease. And when you look at the maintenance chemotherapy, paclitaxel and capecitabine were amongst the most common. About half of those patients with triple negative breast cancer had PD-L1 positive disease. A much lower proportion of patients with hormone receptor positive disease did, about 15%. It's pretty typical for what we've seen in other studies. And when you look at the median progression-free survival for the overall population, you can see that, if anything, chemotherapy fared a bit better than immunotherapy, although this wasn't statistically significant. In looking at the progression-free survival by subgroups, and you know, here on the forest plot, you can see that those patients who had hormone receptor positive disease actually favored continuing standard therapy. Those patients with triple negative breast cancer, as a group, it doesn't seem like necessarily benefited overall. When you look at benefit by PD-L1 status, those patients who had PD-L1 positive disease maybe favored immunotherapy a little bit more. Those patients with PD-L1 negative disease favored the continuing chemotherapy. And then when you look at whether they were responding or not at the time of randomization, you can see obviously those patients who were responding to their therapy fared better if they were able to continue that therapy. And I think we've all seen hormone receptor positive patients who can benefit from taxanes and capecitabine for years. And so I think a lot of that was largely driven by the hormone receptor positive population. In looking at the overall survival for the overall population, again, no significant benefit for either strategy. But when we look at subgroups of interest, there actually were some differences that emerged. When you look at the triple negative patients versus non-triple negative patients, you can see that it seemed to favor the immunotherapy switch, and then for patients with PD-L1 positive disease. So in an exploratory analysis looking at overall survival on the left for patients with triple negative breast cancer and on the right for those with PD-L1 positive disease, you can actually see there is a trend to improvement for overall survival for those patients with triple negative breast cancer and with PD-L1 positive disease. So again, I think, you know, thinking about patient selection, we know that hormone receptor positive patients really, at least to date, haven't really benefited from monotherapy to the same degree as the hormone receptor negative patients. And I think this is really interesting data, and I think could lead to future investigations specifically targeting patients with triple negative breast cancer and PD-L1 positive disease. So the Colette trial was a phase 2 trial that looked at that sort of taxane atezolizumab backbone and added the MEK inhibitor cobimetinib to it. We know that the MEK pathway is activated in a large proportion of patients with triple negative breast cancer. And we know that when MEK is activated, it can actually suppress an inflammatory and immune response. It can lead to decreased antigen presentation and decreased PD-L1 expression. So the idea behind this trial was to add a MEK inhibitor to anti-PD-L1 therapy and chemotherapy and see, could this be an effective strategy? And I think you can see from the waterfall plots here, on the left is the paclitaxel waterfall plot, and then in the middle there is the nab-paclitaxel. Really, paclitaxel, nab-paclitaxel, really impressive responses for patients who got this triplet regimen, and actually pretty reasonably well tolerated. And it didn't really matter for patients if they were PD-L1 positive or PD-L1 negative. Both groups seemed to benefit from this strategy. Another phase 1b trial that was presented at AACR last year looked at the AKT inhibitor ipatasertib, and this again was a triplet combination, ipatasertib plus atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel or paclitaxel. And again, a pretty small study, but really impressive response rates that were seen. And the rationale behind this study is we know that activation of the PI3 kinase AKT P10 pathway can lead to immunotherapy resistance. And so the concept here, I think, looks pretty impressive. And both the cobimetinib and ipatasertib with atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel are moving on and actually are the sort of foundation of an ongoing randomized phase 3 trial to see if we can enhance response rates and get more patients with triple-negative breast cancer to respond to immunotherapy and chemotherapy. So it's pretty typical in all areas of medical oncology. When we see agents that are looking very promising in the advanced cancer setting, we like to move them up to early stage disease and add them to standard of care therapy to see if we add immunotherapy to standard of care therapy, can we actually improve outcomes and cure more women of their early stage disease. So one of the larger randomized phase 2 trials that was done in the neoadjuvant setting was Gepbar-Nuevo, and this was presented a couple of years ago and just published last year in Annals of Oncology. And this was a randomized phase 2 trial that looked at durvalumab with standard of care neoadjuvant therapy with nab-paclitaxel followed by EC. This was primarily done in Germany. And initially on in this study, there was a 2-week window where patients got a lead-in of durvalumab or a placebo before they started their concurrent chemoimmunotherapy regimen. Now, overall, the study, while numerically was associated with a higher pathological complete response rate for those patients who got immunotherapy versus those patients who got chemotherapy alone, interestingly, it was the window where patients got 2 weeks of durvalumab lead-in before they started chemoimmunotherapy that seemed to do the better, or that so-called window cohort. Again, this was a subgroup analysis, but a 20% improvement in PCR rates for the segment of patients who got that lead-in or sort of induction of durvalumab before they started combination therapy. We also saw that those patients with higher stage disease seem to have numerically a higher PCR rate than those patients with who got immunotherapy than those patients who got chemotherapy alone. Another neoadjuvant clinical trial is the I-SPY2 clinical trial. This is an adaptively randomized clinical trial. So there are arms that are constantly entering and exiting this trial. One of the arms of the trial that we presented a couple of years ago looked at 4 doses of pembrolizumab given with paclitaxel followed by AC. This part of the trial, again, because of the adaptive randomization sort of basis for this trial, if it looks like an experimental arm is going to have a predicted probability of success in a subsequently conducted randomized phase 3 trial, that's criteria for graduation, or the regimen looks so good it graduates and then moves on to a randomized phase 3 study. So what we found in the context of this trial, when we added 4 doses of pembrolizumab to paclitaxel followed by AC, we found a tripling in the estimated PCR rates for patients with triple negative breast cancer. And we also actually found a more than doubling in the estimated PCR rates for patients with high risk hormone receptor positive disease. And these were patients who had that mammo print high risk disease. So it wasn't just your garden variety luminal A type of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, the kinds that can benefit primarily from endocrine therapy, but really high-risk disease. And so this was really exciting to see. There are a number of other immunotherapy combinations that have been investigated or are being investigated in the context of the I-SPY2 trial. One arm that was presented at San Antonio this year was really continuing pembrolizumab for 8 cycles without AC. So pembrolizumab plus paclitaxel followed by pembrolizumab alone. And then another looking at adding a PARP inhibitor to durvalumab and paclitaxel followed by AC. And then SD101, which is a toll-like receptor agonist, toll-like receptor 9 agonist that's added. It's actually an intratumoral injection added to pembrolizumab and paclitaxel followed by AC. So the lower two are still ongoing, but the pembrolizumab plus paclitaxel arm was presented at San Antonio this year, and I'll get to that in just a moment. What we did find in the context of the I-SPY2 clinical trial, however, were immune-related adverse events. And something that we saw that was pretty unexpected was the degree of adrenal insufficiency. So we know that endocrinopathies are amongst the most common adverse events that are seen with checkpoint inhibitors. Adrenal insufficiency is pretty uncommon. It's generally under 1%, at least in the metastatic trials that have been reported out to date. Hyper and hypothyroidism are the most common and generally pretty easily managed. But we saw that 6 of the 69 patients who were randomized to the pembrolizumab arm of this trial experienced adrenal insufficiency. And the majority of them, so 5 of the 6, actually presented long after they were done with their pembrolizumab and even after they'd already undergone surgery. So a little bit of a unique finding and something that has been seen in larger subsequent randomized phase 3 trials. The pembrolizumab 8 arm of I-SPY2 was the arm where we dropped the AC. And the idea here was, could we get the same sort of responses and these high PCR rates with just a little bit more immunotherapy and dropping chemotherapy? And what we found was that it really didn't seem to be better than giving AC. So paclitaxel followed by AC had basically the same PCR rate as paclitaxel plus pembro for 8 cycles without the AC. So this is not a strategy that we're going to be moving forward. And we've certainly seen that adding the AC back in gets us even better than just standard chemotherapy alone. So the I-SPY2 clinical trials led to a subsequent randomized phase 3 trial at the KEYNOTE-522 trial. This was a randomized phase 3 trial of chemotherapy with or without pembrolizumab. And here the pembrolizumab was actually given for a year. It was given with standard neoadjuvant chemotherapy and then continued on in the adjuvant setting after surgery. This was a 2-to-1 randomization. The standard chemotherapy backbone here actually added carboplatin into the mix. So carboplatin plus paclitaxel followed by AC or EC, as was the case in Europe. And patients received pembrolizumab every 3 weeks for a total of a year as part of this trial. This trial enrolled patients with early stage triple negative breast cancer who'd not received therapy yet. The primary endpoints of this trial were PCR and event-free survival, and then a bunch of secondary endpoints and exploratory endpoints as well. So this trial, the results were initially presented at ESMO last year, and you can see here on the right-hand side really impressive significant improvement in pathologic complete response rates for those patients who received pembrolizumab versus those patients who got chemotherapy alone. And looking on the right-hand side, you can see here it really didn't matter if you were PD-L1 positive or PD-L1 negative. There was a similar benefit that was seen regardless of PD-L1 status. The first interim analysis for event-free survival was also presented at ESMO last September. And you can see here very early on, and not yet significant, but a really nice trend to improvement in event-free survival. So we've seen in breast cancer in a number of studies, we can get higher PCR rates by adding carboplatin, by adding bevacizumab, or adding both of them. But neither one of those strategies has really improved event-free survival or long-term outcomes. And so I suspect if this continues on the way it is now, that this could very well be the basis for an FDA approval. I'm not really sure where that's at in sort of the pipeline, but really impressive, exciting results that could be very game-changing for a subset of patients with triple-negative breast cancer. What was presented at San Antonio was a little bit more of a deep dive into who are these patients that are benefiting and what is the magnitude of their benefit. So when we looked by stage in this trial, you can see it's actually those patients with later stage disease, stage 3 disease, that seem to have the greatest delta in terms of improvement in PCR, although also significant for patients with stage 2 A and B disease as well. In looking at those patients who had node negative disease versus node positive disease, again, really exciting and interesting to see that those patients with node positive disease actually seem to have the greatest benefit from the addition of a year of pembrolizumab, although also an improvement in those patients with node negative disease. And again, looking at by PD-L1 expression, PD-L1 negative on the left, and then various degrees of positivity, 1%, 10%, 20% cut points. Again, all groups benefited, whether they were PD-L1 positive or PD-L1 negative. However, what was seen were immune-related adverse events, thyroid abnormalities, infusion reaction, rash, the most common. But in the context of this large, almost 1,200-patient clinical trial, they did see a 4.5% incidence of adrenal insufficiency, and that's primary and secondary added together. In I-SPY 2, we saw 8.7. That could just be an artifact of a pretty small study. But, this is a toxicity that we're going to see if this sort of regimen is approved, which I hope it will be in the neoadjuvant setting. That's about 1 in 20 patients will develop adrenal insufficiency. And this is permanent, and it needs to be managed. So I think it's something that we really need to educate providers on as we're, hopefully going to be using this regimen in the early stage setting, because that's not something that we're typically seeing. Colitis, thyroiditis, hepatitis, pneumonitis, all seen, but pretty low incidence. So that was kind of the one unique adverse event that's come out in the neoadjuvant setting that we're seeing. There was another neoadjuvant clinical trial presented at San Antonio, the NeoTRIP trial. This was an Italian study that looked at platinum and nab-paclitaxel chemotherapy with or without atezolizumab. Patients then went on to surgery and then got adjuvant anthracycline-based therapy. Primary endpoint for the study was event-free survival. What they were able to present at San Antonio was the PCR rates. When you look at the two different groups, again, pretty similar across both groups. About half of patients had locally advanced disease. A little over half had PD-L1 positive disease. That was obviously not a criteria for enrollment, but something they did after the fact. And then the vast majority of these patients had node positive disease, so under 15% were node negative. And here you can see this was essentially a negative study. There was no significant improvement in PCR rates for patients who were randomized to eight cycles of atezolizumab in the neoadjuvant setting versus no atezolizumab. They went back and looked by PD-L1 status, and again, no significant difference based on PD-L1 status. looking at early stage disease, early node negative disease versus locally advanced. Again, no benefit to either group. So interestingly, this is the polar opposite of what we saw with the KEYNOTE-522 trial. And I personally suspect it's because the anthracycline is being given after the fact and not in the neoadjuvant setting. We saw from the TONIC trial how synergistic anthracyclines can be with immunotherapy potentially, and that's just my opinion. But we'll see as we follow these patients for event-free survival events. In looking at the adverse events, really pretty well matched by each arm, where we really saw the differences were in the immune-related adverse events, and really the immune-related hepatitis. Here you can see just that most of these immune-related adverse events were pretty low-grade. Thyroid abnormalities, the most common, which is what we'd expect. They did not see any adrenal insufficiency in the context of this trial. So what they concluded was that nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin, with or without atezolizumab, there really was not a significant difference in PCR rates for patients. So we'll continue to follow these patients for event-free survival and other efficacy endpoints, but to date, a negative study, and I somehow doubt we're going to see any difference in event-free survival for these patients. So just to summarize our experience of immunotherapy and breast cancer, we know that monotherapy response rates are pretty modest. We can enhance the group of patients who are going to respond to monotherapy by selecting those patients who are getting these therapies in the frontline setting, those who have PD-L1 positive disease, and those who have an immune infiltrate in their tumor microenvironment. Those are the patients who are most likely to benefit. So I will occasionally see patients who've gotten checkpoint inhibitors for their advanced triple negative breast cancers. They're like seventh or eighth line of therapy. And I think, you know, realistically, we're not going to see benefits in those patients. We need to use these drugs earlier. The earlier, the better. And I think what you've seen is that we're seeing even better improvements in outcomes when they're given in the neoadjuvant or early stage setting. Atezolizumab plus nab-paclitaxel is FDA approved for PD-L1 positive advanced triple negative breast cancer. I didn't get a lot into testing, but the Ventana SP142 is the companion diagnostic for this trial. It is what was used to determine PD-L1 positivity. All antibodies are not the same. Looking at the tumor versus the immune cells versus the combination is not the same. So I really think that the Ventana SP142 assay is the one that's most likely to predict for who's going to benefit and should be used. There's a fair bit of variability between pathologists. Dr. David Rim had a really nice educational session at San Antonio where he talked about how variable it is in pathologists across the country calling a tumor PD-L1 positive versus negative. So I think there are real issues around testing, but that's the best that we've got right now. There are a bunch of different strategies that have been looked at with immunotherapy, this concept of induction, chemotherapy or radiation therapy followed by checkpoint inhibitors, or starting with chemo and then maintenance therapy once you get a response are really interesting. There are subgroups of patients who could very well benefit from strategies like that. Larger studies are ongoing or are being planned. We've also seen that combination therapies, chemotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, and maybe MEK inhibitors or AKT inhibitors are looking really exciting. And those trials, those randomized phase 3 trials are ongoing now. So we very well could be seeing triplet therapy approved in the not too distant future. What we've also seen is that adding pembrolizumab to neoadjuvant chemotherapy in patients with triple negative breast cancer and maybe even high risk hormone receptor positive disease significantly improves PCR rates, but does come at the cost of immune-related toxicities. An unexpected observation was the higher than expected rates of adrenal insufficiency that were seen in the neoadjuvant setting. And there are a lot of questions that remain unanswered. We do not have a great biomarker for who's going to respond to these therapies. I think what you've seen in the neoadjuvant setting is maybe it doesn't even matter if you're PD-L1 positive or negative. Maybe a higher risk node positive breast cancer that's triple negative is the subgroup that will work. But obviously, you know, when we talk about these agents, they do come at the cost of additional toxicities, and trying to better identify who's going to benefit from this strategy and maybe excluding those who are going to have toxicity would be a great path forward in helping us realize precision medicine. This concept of sequencing chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or even radiation therapy, maintenance therapy with a checkpoint blockade are strategies that are looking promising and certainly worthy of further study. I think, what is the optimal chemotherapy backbone? We started with taxanes, but are anthracyclines better? Is there something else that's even better? I think really remains to be seen. The KEYNOTE-522 trial really escalated chemotherapy, but are there going to be opportunities for certain segments of the population to not have as much chemotherapy? I think would also be pretty exciting. There are some cooperative group studies that are going to be ongoing, looking at who are these patients who can benefit from monotherapy, who are the patients who need chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and who are those patients who aren't going to benefit from immunotherapy. So I think a lot of interesting work that will be coming down the line to help us better understand who's going to benefit from which strategy. And then obviously understanding immune-related toxicities, who's at risk, identifying them early, and managing them to minimize morbidity, I think is going to be very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the talk. Just a couple questions, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
So patients newly diagnosed triple negative breast cancer, nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab, what's your strategy? A lot of times patients will get, you know, so if they have a good response, they get several months of that. And then they, if they continue to have a good response, they start to get fatigued and don't want to come in as often to the office. Or, you know, what's your strategy for maybe de-escalating some of the chemo? Do you cut back the dose a bit, or do you omit maybe the day 8 dose in that regimen? And then after that, after they've eventually progressed, what's your next line? What do you prefer as your next couple lines of therapy?
Yeah. So the first question about chemotherapy, I drop it. If I'm getting a really nice response, you know, because people will develop neuropathy, especially if they had early stage therapy and they're not de novo metastatic, they're going to start to develop neuropathy. So once I get to a pretty good response on imaging, and, you know, you can argue what is that good response, but, you know, I'll generally stop chemotherapy. If they start to progress, I'll consider adding it back in to see if I can sort of get an immune response or a response to therapy. If not, then certainly move on to something else. But I think that's very reasonable. And they did do that in the context of the trial. These patients did not continue, you know, chemotherapy for 2 years for those patients who, you know, had these really prolonged responses. I think beyond that, you know, obviously trials are wonderful to be able to offer patients, but if you don't have access, you know, I think that there are going to be some therapies that will be approved in the not too distant future. MU-132 or sacituzumab is an antibody drug conjugate that targets TROP2. It may be possible to get compassionate use. I've heard some folks being successful in that route, but that's a drug that's going to be coming out, and that drug looks phenomenal. I mean, I've had patients who've not responded to anything respond to that as in the trial. I mean, 2 years out and still on this therapy, blew through everything else. So I think there are some new drugs that are going to be coming down the line. The DS-8201 in the HER2 talk is now in studies for patients with HER2 low expressing. So technically triple negative, but HER2 1+2+, and the data there in that setting is looking really phenomenal as well. So I think there are other things that are coming down the line in maybe the not too distant future. I suspect sacituzumab will be FDA approved this year. They didn't get it their first time around, but I know they've resubmitted. So fingers crossed that will be an option. But, you know, beyond that, I think it's just musical chairs, chemotherapy, Carbogem, I'll use, Eribulin, I'll use, you know, I think capecitabine, you know, a lot of people have said that they don't really think capecitabine is all that effective for triple negative disease and don't even bother trying it. But I personally have had a number of patients respond very well to capecitabine. So I think also an option. I think the flip side, though, is those patients who are PD-L1 negative, you know, it's disappointing to miss out on immunotherapy. But I think, you know, you've seen that the benefits are quite modest, so there's certainly a long way to go. And then I would recommend testing everybody for BRCA 1 and 2 in the off chance that they're positive and could benefit from a PARP inhibitor.
For triple negative patients who achieve a true path CR regardless of the induction therapy, once you've achieved a path CR, whether it's 40% or 60%, is there any prospective data to suggest that they benefit from further therapy? In other words, if you have achieved a path CR regardless of the induction therapy, is there any data to suggest that on balance that they will benefit from additional chemotherapy?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any. And, you know, there are two schools of thought out there, that it matters what you get to get your PCR and that it doesn't matter what you get. And if you get a PCR, it's a PCR. I'm in that second category. I think if you get a PCR, however you get there, I think you're going to do similarly as well as people who get there using other therapies. I think the one point, though, is immunotherapy going to change that, right? Because you can have ongoing sustained sort of immune activation. So, but in general, for non-immunotherapy, I think how you get there probably doesn't matter. So, you know, some of these trials looking at PARP inhibitors as monotherapy for mutation carriers, or even platinums, cisplatin, the response rates are looking really high. If I got somebody who got to a PCR, I don't know that I necessarily feel like they need more therapy.
In the study, and I forgot the name of it, but the study of the immunotherapy plus the taxane that led to the approval of the use of immunotherapy plus the taxane in metastatic.
Oh, the IMPASSION 130 trial.
So,
yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that study, would we have seen a better result had they used an anthracycline, if anthracycline is more synergistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a question that remains to be answered. We don't know that.
Do we have any idea what there is about the anthracycline that potentially might make it more synergistic?
No, I mean, it's just an observation from that TONIC trial, right? So I'm happy to share these slides, but different chemotherapies can stimulate the immune response in different ways, right? And so how an anthracycline stimulates the immune response might be a better strategy in breast cancer versus a taxane or an alkylating agent, I think we still don't know. But, you know, again, the TONIC trial, that was the small trial with the induction sort of chemotherapy followed by nivolumab, you know, the anthracycline looked really good. And it was just two low doses given a week apart, and that was it, with nivolumab after. So, I mean, again, a small study, there were only 17 patients in that arm, but the response rate was 35%, which is definitely, you know, I don't think a fluke.
Sure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your talk. With Lehman's subtype molecular analysis of mm-hmm. triple negative breast cancer into, whether you say six or seven different molecular subtypes, do you happen to know, is there any correlative studies regarding the gene expression profiling of those subtypes and the effects on immunotherapy?
No, I mean, that hasn't been studied. On his last sort of revision of those subtypes, he's down to four. So the immunomodulatory subtype kind of got rolled into some of the other subtypes. So there's the basal-like one, basal-like two, the mesenchymal stem cell-like, and the luminal AR. So he's down to four subtypes now, with the immunomodulatory and I think the mesenchymal being absorbed into those larger four. You can actually see immune infiltration in all four of those subtypes. And no one has done, I mean, you know, he's done this work and it's fabulous. And I think it can help us, you know, generally think about strategies for triple negative breast cancer, but that's not really used clinically to determine a therapy. In fact, we actually have done a study with Vanderbilt looking at androgen receptor blockade and the luminal AR subtype, and it doesn't really correlate well. You know, you can have luminal AR and not benefit from androgen receptor blockade, or you can have not a luminal AR subtype and benefit. There was a paper that just came out like a month ago where we looked at enzalutamide with or without teselicib, which is now a PI3 kinase inhibitor that's being no longer developed because of toxicity. So I think those strategies are great to try to identify novel sort of targets, but it's not used clinically yet. What is being looked at is a interferon signature and how that might correlate. So I think that would make life a lot easier if we could send for a signature as opposed to this whole PD-L1 testing, which is really fraught with a lot of issues in terms of the antibodies that used, what compartment you look at, what the cut point is. It's all over the place. And I think there are some significant challenges when you look at the variability of what's called PD-L1 positive versus negative across pathologists. There's just not great reproducibility there. So I, you know, the hope is that strategies like a signature or something, I don't think it's just going to be as simple as PD-L1 and TILs and the line of therapy. You know, hopefully there's going to be a collection of genes that can help to predict who's going to benefit from these strategies. As part of the I-SPY2 neoadjuvant trial, we do serial biopsies. So that's going to be, I think, a great a collection of tumors that might help us, at least in the neoadjuvant setting, understand who are these people and what signatures predict for a response to these therapies. And in the metastatic setting, there are trials. The IMPASSION trial did not mandate a pretreatment and on-treatment biopsy, but there are trials that are doing that. And so that might help us identify what kind of a signature predicts for benefit. And then if you don't have it, if you can acquire it over the course of treatment, can that predict for benefit? So I think all of those studies are ongoing. We just don't have data from them yet. But really important studies. You know, I think it's always a hassle to get patients to say, you know, have these research biopsies, but it just informs us so well and how we want to use these therapies down the road.
So then I guess my other question would be is if you have somebody that you're doing neoadjuvant treatment for a triple negative, no matter whatever you're giving them, and you elect to do, if you're clinically noticing not that you're not having a great response, mm-hmm. or if you follow the data that says there's such good correlation with preoperative MRI data, the preoperative MRI data, I guess the things that we've seen have really shown that a negative MRI is a good test predicting a pathologic complete response. But if you have somebody that's not responding very well with neoadjuvant treatment, do you still keep pushing on neoadjuvant treatment and switch to something else? Because we know they have a significantly worse outcome if they have significant disease left.
Yeah.
And then the adjuvant capecitabine data has been essentially debunked a little bit. What's your thoughts on kind of that difficult situation?
So a couple presentations at San Antonio this year, actually, where they tried to correlate MRI after neoadjuvant therapy with random biopsies, and it actually is not so great. So we're not ready for that yet. I think for triple negative breast cancer, for HER2 positive breast cancer, it's better than for ER positive disease, but it's not good enough where we're ready to forego surgery at this point. So MRIs are pretty good, but not 100%. And so we really need them to be much better before we're going to consider that strategy. In terms of the capecitabine data, actually there was a meta-analysis that was presented at San Antonio this year that actually does show, and it kind of reinforces the CREATE-X data. So I am using capecitabine adjuvantly for triple negative patients who don't achieve a PCR. But in terms of what I personally do may be different from what other people do, but, you know, I give all my triple negatives, for the most part, neoadjuvant therapy. And if they're not responding to their taxane or they're not responding to their anthracycline, I don't keep giving it to them. Usually about halfway between, like 6 weeks into taxane to the paclitaxel and after two of AC, if I'm not seeing the tumor budge, I usually move on. And, you know, if we've, you know, you could consider carbo, you know, kind of throwing carbo into the mix if to see if you can get a response there. But, you know, if I don't get a PCR at the time of surgery, then I absolutely will do capecitabine for 6 to 8 cycles or a trial if you've got something that you know, patient can have access to. That's my strategy. Not all would agree with me, but, you know, if I'm not seeing the tumor budge, I'm just not optimistic that I'm doing anything with that therapy. Growing is a completely different, you know, absolutely you're going to move on. But, you know, some people will stay the course if they're seeing stable disease, but I'm just generally not happy with that strategy because I just feel like I'm giving someone toxicity and potentially no benefit from that therapy.
Thank you very much for an excellent talk. And so that includes the educational part of the meeting. We're going to have a short, very short business meeting. And everybody's welcome to stay. This is an open meeting. And I'll just take my stuff up to the podium. We'll get it done.
If I could just make a quick
Well, I actually don't know how many members are here. There's probably a few. The main thing is we need more members. So if you are a physician, a nurse practitioner, you pharmacists, you're all welcome to join NOS. And obviously, we put on several meetings a year. The big one, of course, is this one, an ASCO review. We need people to help with planning. We need other people's ideas. We do have a board, an executive committee, which is Dr. Hauke, who I'm standing into for today because he managed to be on call when he organized this meeting. Dr. Tarantolo is the past president. Secretary Treasurer is Dr. Sue. And our board is fairly small. Myself, Dr. Raymakers, Dr. Reno, and Dr. Vizzuri are the four at-large board members. Now, I believe our bylaws allow for more board members, so if anybody's interested in joining the board, along with joining the society, you're certainly welcome. Dr. Block does serve as our hematology carrier CAC representative that has to do with Medicare issues, and that actually they sort of eliminated oncology, hematology, oncology are into one. The next areas that we need to kind of look at for this coming year is our priorities and strategically. There's always legislative priorities, and we do review that with the Nebraska Medical Association, what bills in Nebraska would have impact on cancer care, cancer patients in general, along with good public health, such as smoking issues and issues of the opioid crisis. So one can get very active into that. We do support, of course, you know, this is a state society sponsored by ASCO. So the ASCO meetings and ASCO committees, we encourage people to get involved with. We also, in the past, have had donated some of our funds to the Conquer Cancer Investigational Awards. 1 year we did the Young Investigators Award. This year that would constitute $57,500. Last year we did a Merit Award, which was $40,000, and there's a couple other that are listed. We plan on doing one of those again this year. If you join or you're a member and you have input on which one or amounts in that, we certainly the board would certainly be pleased to hear from the membership. So other than that, I'm just going to open it for a short. If anybody has anything to discuss, we can certainly talk about anything. Otherwise, thank you for coming to this meeting, and I think it was very beneficial. The Nebraska medical people want to say something.
Yeah, Amy Reynolds from Nebraska Medical Association, Executive Vice President. I'm going to give you a quick That'd be perfect. Bills that we'd like your input and feedback on. We have been extremely busy in this very short session with the legislature. We've got several scope of practice expansion bills, of which we've been able to defeat two. But what is looming over all physicians who are part of the CAP, the fund, the Hospital Medical Liability Fund, is there's a bill on the floor, or in committee, sorry, LB 1133, that will increase the cap tenfold. So this would take the $500,000 limit for a lawsuit on physicians to $5 million, and it would take the maximum lawsuit payment of $2.25 to $20 million, and it increases the hospital liability to $30 million. Our state would shut down with access to providers if this happens. We need everybody to get behind it. It's LB 1133. Carmen's going to be communicating with all specialty societies specifically about this bill. Carmen's your executive director, brand new, brought on board in November. Just a shout out to her for what she pulled together in a quick 6 weeks of being on the job. So I really feel like it's important. If you're not familiar with the medical malpractice liability cap, reach out to me and I'll educate you very quickly. But this is why Nebraska is such a great place for physicians to practice, because we have one of the lowest caps for lawsuits on physicians, whereas other states look at physicians out of pocket around 10 to 15 million. That's their out of pocket. We do not want our cap to get there. So we have a senator who introduced it. It's Senator Wayne. If you live in his district, I would strongly encourage you to reach out to him and educate him. He's very familiar with the fund. His concept is, if he can go after a negligent driver of a vehicle for any amount of money, he feels like he should be able to go after any negligent physician for any amount of money. And so that's his only justification. We thought the trial attorneys were behind this, and they are not. They're actually laughing at it because they know it doesn't really work that way. So we're definitely going to need all of your support on this bill. There's a couple other bills out there. I don't know if they pertain to you. One is an out-of-network billing bill. We know that nationally has been kind of gaining momentum. Some healthcare agencies or healthcare insurance payers would tell you, let's wait and let the federal government figure this out. The federal government's not going to figure this out. They're wrapped up in an impeachment, in case people didn't know. We can't even get meetings scheduled with our own representatives and senators right now, and I'll be there next week. So we're not waiting. We're actually working with Senator Moorfield. He has a pretty decent bill developed, and I apologize, I don't have the bill number memorized. I try to not memorize the bill numbers. This bill essentially would pay in-network rates directly to the provider for a patient who comes through in an emergent situation only. So that direct in-network payment would go straight to the provider. If the provider disputes that, feels they should be paid a little more than that, they can then go back and ask for more, and it would go through a mediation process. So the way his bill's different than a lot of other states and the national, the federal bill, is that providers already get the in-network rate as if that patient already were in the network. It's not 125% of Medicare rate, which is going to be significantly lower, we know. It's the in-network rate. We worked with him on that to ensure that our providers don't take anything less than an in-network rate. It's the mediation part that we have heartburn over, because our private practice physicians don't have the capacity to go through mediation like the payers do. They've got their own law firms that can fight this. So we're trying to work with him. He's got the insurers in his ears. We got Medica to hopefully compromise on part of it, and we want to get them on our side so we can gain some momentum against Blue Cross Blue Shield and United Healthcare. So know that we're working that bill pretty hard. In reality, the bill doesn't go anywhere. It's going to get killed in committee, which is unfortunate, because I take a lot of calls from a lot of physicians who are struggling with this. And I'm trying to think of any other. Oh, service. Yes. So Senator Breezy introduced a bill that would increase, that would actually, it removes any exemptions for any services. So you would then be taxed on every service. So you'd be taxed for getting your hair cut, your nails done, but also seeking medical treatment. That's a service. So all of your patients would receive a 4% increase in what their bills would be. So it's compromising from the 7%, 7.5% down to 4%, but it's pulling in all these exempted service delivery entities. This is probably, we're expecting to be the longest hearing in legislature history to take place on that bill. It's amazing. I've been by his office. He's got a line out the door all the time. People are really up in arms on this bill. So that's something you might want to pay attention to, because we know that cost is definitely a deterrent to seek health care. You raise it 4%, it's going to be even more of a, what? It's the service exemption, it's the tax exemption on services bill. I've got my bill chart out in my bag. I can grab that for you. But it's Senator Breezy. If you look him up on the legislative website, you can pull that bill. We did support, like, a lot of tobacco tax, removing the flavors. So as we talk about oncology, we are supporting those efforts. The bill Senator Kavanaugh introduced, I think it's it's connected to 766, but it's a bill held over from last year. She compromised on a 50-cent increase tax per pack of cigarettes instead of $1.50. That bill got hung up in committee. We're tied at a 4-4 vote right now to get it out of committee. So we're actually working that one on the backside. We're okay with a compromise of 50 cents. It's better than nothing. However, there's a lot of advocates in the public health arena that aren't. It's an all or nothing in their book. We don't see it that way at the NMA. We see that as that compromise is still going to deter other folks from initiating into tobacco smoking. So that bill's there. There's several tobacco tax bills that we're following, and we're definitely supporting any increase in taxes and any increase in restriction. We also did support the increase in tax on soda and candy. It's simply for public health. We're not in the tax world at the NMA. We're not about raising taxes on people, but it's a public health impact. And as one of our physician members stated, all of you are expected, or at least general practitioners, our family practice, pediatricians are expected, whether they see their patients or not, they are dinged for their patient population that come through the emergency room for an emergent situation where it could have been handled in the clinic, right? But they're also dinged by MIPS and HEDIS measures if their patients are diagnosed as obese, diabetic, pre-diabetic, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. Their reimbursement rates take a hit. So for the general concept of that, we're supporting increased tax, which deters access of soda and candy. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but I wanted you to know there's several bills that would impact oncology, maybe not directly, but your practice. And Carmen can fill you in on what those are. If you're an NMA member, I don't know who in the room's a physician and who's not. If you're a physician in the room and you're not a member, I would strongly encourage you to join. And there's a whole plethora of reasons why I feel like we would benefit you as a physician, whether you're an employed physician or private practice. But secondly, if you are a member, you can access our bill chart online using your member portal username and login at any time, and you can see where we're at. We update that bill chart regularly, right now daily, and it will tell you everything about our position, when the hearings are, if the bill was prioritized, etc. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for that update. And again, let's give Carmen a round of applause. I thought she did a great job of pulling this together. Short notice and really not a lot of information to work on, so you did a fabulous job. So with that, unless anybody else has any other comments, we'll go have lunch.